The editor was indignant. Thomas Moore Stork, the octogenarian publisher editor of the Santa Barbara, California News Press, was writing with an angry pen. This editor and publisher is in his 85th year. His entire life has been spent in this community. He lived here when conditions were rugged, when West was West and where men were men. He lived during periods when if a man or a group of men openly or by mouth or by the printed word called our president, others at the head of this government traitors, they were called to answer. Such slander often called for a visit from a courageous and irate group which brought with them a barrel of feathers. Whom was Editor Stork recommending for this public horsewhipping? The local chapter of a semi-secret national political organization known as the John Birch. Why? Stork's indictment had three counts. The first, contumacious slander. Unsigned letters and anonymous telephone calls were circulating about Santa Barbara to the effect that President Eisenhower was a knowing and willing agent of the Communist Party, that his brother, Dr. Milton Eisenhower, was his immediate superior in the Communist Party, and that the late Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, his brother, Alan Dulles, the head of our Central Intelligence Agency, were members of the Communist Underground. The second item of this indictment was one of criminal extortion. Local business people were being solicited for the John Birch. And if they refused to contribute to this campaign of vilification, they were being informed that a whispering campaign of character assassination would be developed against them. If you do not contribute to our crusade against the Reds, we'll label you a Red. Finally, Stork accused the John Birch of scandalous witch hunting. Santa Barbara, the Birch had a junior auxiliary. There is a campus of the University of California in this community. A group of students had been organized on the campus to spy upon the professors to attend their lectures and to deliberately distort, misquote, past rumors against those men who were believed to be politically unfriendly. Publisher Stork did not succeed in the prime purpose of this February 23rd editorial, that was to force this John Birch to come up from their underground, to drop the mantle of their anonymity, and to admit their identity, and to accept, as do all American citizens, the responsibility, the personal responsibility for their actions and for their charges. But he did succeed in focusing a national spotlight upon this organization, was revealed to us as an association of the frustrated and the malcontent, a group which was proliferating through many an American community, despite its patently un-American program of operation. In Amarillo, Texas, the John Birch had undertaken a campaign to silence the pulpit. Protestant minister, it was argued, had no right to speak out on contemporary issues. And when one of the ministers of the local Presbyterian church refused to be silenced and gagged, his church was broadcasted with a letter, unsigned, to the effect that he was an agent of the communists, the vestry of the church were dupes of the communists, the National Council of Churches of Christ, that venerable body representing the vast bulk of Protestant Christianity in America, was a knowing tool of Moscow. The minister's crime, concern for America today. In Wichita, Kansas, the John Birch infiltrated the local Chamber of Commerce. They got control of the program committee, and they used the platform and the prestige of the Chamber of Commerce for a campaign of vilification against the labor unions. Labor unions were catalysts of the communist conspiracy. Labor leaders were cataloged as dupes and tools of Moscow. The Chamber of Commerce became the center for the dissemination of a vast campaign aimed at not only passing right-to-work legislation, but at negating and nullifying the various collective bargaining contracts and laws in the state of Kansas. And nationally, the John Birch has been engaged in a campaign to impeach Mr. Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court. His crime, according to the John Birch, treason. By treason, they mean that he wrote, signed the unanimous Supreme Court decision ordering the desegregation of our schools. Now, what separates the John Birch from other fringe groups in the extreme right wing of our political horizon is its method of operation. It is designedly underground. It is determined to be unscrupulous, to put aside all principle, all standards of propriety, all respect for common, time-honored American decencies. The founder of the John Birch is a New England ex-candy manufacturer by the name of Welch. On December 3rd of 1958, he summoned to Indianapolis, Indiana, 11 of the more wealthy members of the constant assembly of the malcontent in America, and he spoke to them for 2 days and two nights, certainly in itself a record. And he cataloged for them the need for a new, what he called, anti-communist organization. And he quickly identified the communism that he meant. Communism was trade unionism. Communism was ministers who preach a social gospel. Communism were our minimum wage laws. The income tax was a communist bit of legislation. Civil rights legislation, simply a convenient method of communist propaganda. He was even against mental health and water fluoridation. He had in mind, obviously, something larger and broader than concern with the expanding Russian and Chinese imperialism. And the men approved, and the men applauded. And these 11 wealthy patrons became 26. And the John Birch was organized with a new outlook for the ultra-right-wing reactionary group in America. There was to be action. No more temporization. No more concern with quibbling over this philosophic principle or that. What was needed were men of determination. Men who would have no scruples at what was ordered for them. The organization was to be monolithic, authoritarian. Welch was the organizer, philosopher, Fuhrer. Locally, the groups were to be organized into cells. The cells were to be anonymous and autonomous and secret. They were to receive their orders from local coordinators who were to be full-time employees of the John Birch. What were they to do? To silence liberals by vilification? To infiltrate respected community organizations to use their pressure and their platforms to the ends of the John Birch, and to speak in the accepted vernacular to gain approval from all conservative elements in America. The White Citizens' Councils were to be organized as John Birch societies, because the John Birch too approved of states' rights. The John Birch too looked upon the desegregation order as a bit of communist program. Business groups were to be organized because the John Birch was anti-labor, anti-union. Patriotic societies were to be organized because the John Birch was also anti-communist. But it became evident that Mr. Welch had something more in mind even than a new McCarthy-type anti-communist crusade. For the John Birch has not attempted to do what McCarthy did, to teach the Federal Bureau of Investigation how to carry on its own business. The John Birch has instead concentrated itself on silencing within communities the organs of public expression in an attempt to undo all the social legislation which has made America strong and prosperous during the last 30 years. John Birch would return America to the 1890s for communists induced Americans to adopt interstate commerce regulations, to allow the government to interfere in the marketplace to protect the employee from unscrupulous employers, before monopolies were restrained, before estate taxes were imposed, and before that crime of crimes, the federal income tax, came into being. What Welch's purpose, personal purpose, was and is still unknown. I suspect that he looked upon the John Birch not only as a method of writing what he considered to be the inadequacies of current American life, but also as a means of precipitating himself into power in America. All members of the right wing remember that only 7 years ago, the junior senator from Wisconsin was the second most powerful politician in the United States. Mr. Welch is a frustrated politician. He has run in his own state of Massachusetts for local office, and he has received the support that he deserves. Now, how shall we assess the John Birch? Attorney General Robert Kennedy said quite frankly the other day and quite accurately that it has made no significant contribution to the anti-communist crusade, that it has not revealed subversion, sabotage. And he suggested that the best way of dealing with the John Birch was with humorous contempt. There have been many editorials in the same vein. Obviously, the John Birch is not going to strengthen our defenses in the world. But I wonder if humorous contempt and sarcasm is sufficient answer. It is true that as yet the John Birch numbers but a few thousand crackpots, extremists, frustrated individuals. Here in Cleveland, the leader of the John Birch is an unemployed 39-year-old machinist whose previous enthusiasm was the distribution of anti-Catholic hate literature during the last campaign. And they've attracted such people throughout the country. And even the 26 men of wealth and position, 12 of whom appear in Who's Who in America, even this National Advisory Board of 26 reveal themselves on closer inspection to be of that group of perennial malcontents, of men whom the times have passed by, of men who have a name or wealth or achieved in their youth or maturity some position in American life, but who have been frustrated since then and find that the America which surrounds them is not to their liking. The John Birch is, as of the moment, negligible in strength, although it can, as in Santa Barbara, create confusion and sow the seeds of discontent. But you know, in life, nothing is sure but death itself. And by a strange coincidence, this week there will open in a court in Jerusalem the trial of Carl Adolf Eichmann. And one cannot help but be reminded that 1923, another ambitious reactionary, another trafficker in fear and frustration and innuendo and vilification, published his battle plan, Mein Kampf. And that people then said, it's best to treat this offhandedly. Germany will never believe Hitler's fantastics. They believed. Men, if times are ripe, such as Welch, will be believed. And so it is wise for Americans to review what happened in Germany in the 1920s and early 1930s and ask themselves how we can prevent this venom from attacking the body politic of the American political system. Where did Hitler gain strength? What made it possible for seemingly intelligent Germans to accept this potpourri of promises and pledges and vilification and hatred? Where did Hitler gain his strength? Hitler gained his muscle from the unemployed. You remember after the First World War, there was a great difficulty in reestablishing German industry. Millions of German men were out of work for periods ranging from 6 months to 6 years. Millions of bitter men. Then in the mid-1920s, most of them found work only in the late 1920s to be precipitated again out of work by the great worldwide depression. These men, Weimar government was a failure. Failure because it could not provide for them occupation, food for themselves and their family, security. And they turned to the prophets of the right, to a gospel of sheer naked power. Hitler promised them jobs and glory. Bitter, frustrated, and angry, they accepted this promise. Now, we in America have been an exceedingly abundant land. The last 15 years have been years of growth and rather full employment. We have seen in the last 6 months the rolls of the unemployed grow to 6 million. And we have seen, more frightening yet, an increasing growth in the numbers of the unemployable. Technological revolution, automation, population explosion, all these have contributed to a growing number of men for whom there are no jobs and apparently can be no jobs. Now, if our own native fascists cannot conscript their muscle from the unemployed, they will not be able to conscript their legions. And if Americans are concerned with promoting our democracy in the years ahead, we must be vitally concerned with the strength of our economy. We're seeing to it that our economy is developing at such a rate that 1.5 million jobs can be provided each year for those who are entering the labor market. To see to it that our educational systems and our trade unions and our business organizations are cooperating, all of them, to rehabilitate, and relocate, and retrain, and all of them are concerned with the unemployment, employment dimension of American life. On this level, the battle against totalitarianism on our own shores will be won or will be lost. And in the elections of 1929 and 1932, Hitler won massive support not only from the unemployed, but from the impoverished. Do you remember the runaway inflation which infected Germany in the early 1920s? And we have spoken already of the violent depression which shook Germany in the late 1920s. The aged, the infirm, the retired saw their life savings disappear, turn into nothingness. They had put away for their old age, and they turned to draw upon this nest egg, and the egg was broken. And they too mistrusted their government. They too were filled with anger, bitterness. And they too turned to a man who promised so to order the society that there would be, under his orders, security, health, medicine, food, shelter for the aged. Now in the years ahead, this prosperous land of ours, this land which more than any other has distributed rather equally its wealth, will be challenged by a growing number, a growing percentage of the elderly. And unless we find ways and means of providing federal and local support for their needs, unless we too control inflation, unless we too protect their savings, unless we too develop federal programs under democratic auspices which guarantee that their old age will be a good age, we will find that these millions, tired, lonely, and unhappy people, will turn to the demagogue and will lend him their vote and their support. But no demagogue in history has won his way to power only on votes and on muscle. Every demagogue needs a treasury. Where did Hitler get his support, his millions? From German industrialists, from the Krupps and the Essens, the steel manufacturers and the burghers of the German communities. And why? Because he promised to control communism. Because he promised to control the unions, and because he promised to grant them tax advantage. They would continue to have their privileged position in the German economy. They would continue to control their relations with the worker. And from the Liberty League to the John Bright, tragically but true, the demagogues on the American scene, our own native reactionaries, have found many an industrialist who was willing to patronize their activities out of the vain hope that the tax picture might be righted in behalf of the industrialist, that the unions would be broken, that the necessity of collective bargaining would be abrogated, and that marketplace red of tooth and claw, the jungle which was ours in the 19th century, would again be possible in the 20th. Three ex-presidents of the National Association of Manufacturers were on the rolls of the advisory committee of the John Birch. Business itself must prove its patriotism, must prove its fundamental belief in democracy and its acceptance of social justice as an end. It is not enough for big business to develop public relations vice presidents who contribute gently and generously the stockholders' funds to the United Appeal. Big business must see that its presidents, in their actions, by their political pressures, sponsor and encourage and patronize those agencies in American life which make for the dynamism and the future and the honor of the American life. Certainly, this exposure of these three men and their relationships to the NAM makes us think that the NAM needs a bit of intellectual spring cleaning. Business itself must resolve not to sponsor these demagogues. And how did Hitler draw together all these webs of power? What promise did he make to all the Germans? He promised them victory. Remember Versailles. Remember when your nose was rubbed in the mud. I will make the German eagle scream out. I will allow the German boot to goose-step its way through Europe. I will give you a peace with glory, with honor, not the degradation of Versailles. This is a heady brew for the political adolescent. This is a heady brew for the military castes and cadres in any nation. The John Birch and all right-wing organizations are heavily larded with names of retired military senior officers and personnel. I will give you victory. That is the promise of the demagogue. But can there be victory for America in this world of ours, or for Russia, or for any other nation? There is war, there is no victory possible. To win is to be defeated. If there is peace, there must be coexistence, and coexistence is compromise. It is accommodation. It is the give and take of political treaty and arrangement. It is Laos. It is the Suez. It is Korea. It is a line drawn halfway between your ambitions, your expectations, and your needs. America will not in the world today gain political victory in international relations. We cannot expect it. And unless we want to feed the fires and the enthusiasms of the demagogues of the right, we Americans must learn to accept half a loaf, to know that it is better than none. America must be strong. America must be determined, morally positioned. But America cannot expect the world to dance to its own tune. And Americans cannot undertake spy hunts, claim treason, sabotage in high office. We do not, Geneva, or the United Nations, or in Washington, or in Moscow, or in Paris, achieve all that we had hoped to achieve. The demagogue will promise you the world. He means his world. A world of autocracy, a world controlled, a world without law, a world which has no respect for due process, a world without freedom. But he promises you victory. This then is the challenge of America posed to us by the John Birch. To look to our economy, to plan intelligently our productivity, to distribute wisely our wealth, to secure for the aged dignified existence, secure life, to be sure of our own first principles, to respect law and order, to be patient, and above all else, recognize that in the world of 1961, the desirable is impossible. All of our ambitions cannot be fulfilled, and that we must learn to live with neighbors whom we dislike and some whom we contemn, in one world, at peace, and with whatever measure of justice we can accommodate between the nations. Amen.